We will make clear during my visit what our position is with respect to Southern Africa and our strong support for majority rule in Southern Africa. We will also make clear our support for the development objectives of African nations. And finally, we will make clear our support for the unity of African nations. We have no interest in splitting the African nations or lining them up into groups, some of which support one superpower and others support another superpower. But we believe, of course, that this requires restraint by all sides, and this would be our definition.
Specifically on that, how will the Soviets have to act to convince the United States that they are acting responsibly in Africa?
Well, they would have to act to live up to these principles of not interfering with military force and or large-scale military equipment in internal African problems. And we believe, of course, that Cuban troops should be withdrawn from Africa.
Secretary, what are the Cubans and the Soviet Union doing at this particular time? Angola is now more or less over. Is there still a flow of Soviet arms? Is there still a replacement or a continuing level of Cuban forces in Angola? And what do you is your perception of what the Cuban surrogate forces will be doing next?
The present level of Cuban forces in Africa, including all the countries, is in excess of 15,000. Our estimate of Cuban forces in Angola is 13 or 14,000. There has been some rotation, that is, troops have been replaced by other more technical personnel, but the total number of Cuban forces in Angola is roughly at the level at which it has been since the end of January. We receive conflicting reports about what Cuban forces are doing in other parts of Africa or whether Cuban forces from Angola are being moved from Angola to other areas. We have had no confirmed reports, but we have warned repeatedly that the use of Cuban surrogate forces is going to increase international tensions enormously and is going to be incompatible with the relaxation of tensions and is going to be a very dangerous course.
Secretary, to go back to Mr. Freed's question, may we assume that the chances for a SALT agreement in the present political climate for the foreseeable future are pretty much eliminated?
Well, I don't want to disillusion you, the face of your frequent predictions on this subject. As the President pointed out yesterday, we remain prepared to continue the SALT negotiations, and we believe that an equitable SALT agreement is possible and is desirable. We are not operating against an artificial deadline. We are studying the Soviet reply. We've had several meetings on the subject, and we will answer it in due course. I would not preclude the possibility that significant progress can be made this year.
Secretary, some observers have noted that there may be a contradiction in the American pledges of support for black majority rule in Southern Africa and your warnings against Cuban or Soviet interference, in that some of the black nations may be hoping on relying on Cuban or Soviet help in freeing, in achieving the objective of black African rule. I want to ask you whether you feel on this trip you can make credible the American commitment to support black African majority rule.
Well, of course, the achievement of African objectives has to be primarily an African problem. But I will be prepared to discuss with my African hosts the concrete policies that could be implemented to bring about majority rule. And I will be prepared to put forward what the United States in its turn is prepared to do or to support. I do not accept the proposition that the use of extra-continental military force supported by one of the superpowers is the only way of achieving the aspirations of the black African countries. And it is indeed our belief that it is the way that leads to the greatest danger that Africa will become a part of the great power rivalry. So we recognize that this strong desire exists on the part of the black African nations, that it must be given a realistic perspective, and we believe that this is achievable.
Secretary, do you think that majority rule in Rhodesia is possible in the next decade?
Yes, I do.
Mr. Secretary, can we go back to Bintan for a moment? I'd like to read you and invite your comment a quotation from a Tony Lewis column last week. He's writing about your speeches across the country. He says, "The Kissinger Roadshow has a desperate tone, and no wonder. For the Secretary of State is campaigning at the same time on behalf of a policy and of a president who has effectively abandoned that policy. How much is your own administration responsible for the slow progress in détente at this point, leaving aside the Reagans and the Jacksons?"
Well, I have noticed that the op-ed page of the New York Times is not unanimous in support of me. And the policy that I have stated is, of course, the policy of the president. The statements about the objectives of the United States with respect to relations with the Soviet Union are the views of the president, as of course they are my own views. And therefore, I cannot accept the particular statement that you have read. We have, as I pointed out at the time, as a result of Watergate, of the aftermath of Watergate, of a series of congressional executive disagreements, we have suffered from a lack of clarity about in other countries' mind about what the United States can and will do in given circumstances. For this, we have paid a price. This we are attempting to rectify, and this any administration will have to overcome. But the basic objective of seeking to prevent Soviet expansion and at the same time to build a safer world than one that depends entirely on nuclear confrontation, those objectives are fixed and will have to be pursued by any administration.
But are you making a brief follow-up, if I may? But aren't you making any concessions on your own to the fact that there is a political campaign going on now? Isn't détente slowing down by U.S. Desires, by administration desires?
The primary problem in relations with the Soviet Union has been the irresponsible Soviet actions in Angola. The basic foreign policy of the United States depends on the national interest of the United States, and it is not a partisan matter.
Mr. Secretary, you talked about Watergate. Going beyond Watergate, given the fact that we are now in a presidential campaign with the inevitable attacks on foreign policy, are you finding that these attacks are affecting the perception of the United States abroad and affecting America's ability to operate on the international arena?
Well, inevitably. When the United States is described as second rate, when it is alleged that senior officials of the United States government are resigned to getting the best deal they can from a nation that is perceived to be dominant. All charges which are wrong and irresponsible, inevitably, this is bound to affect the perceptions of other countries. On the other hand, I believe that other countries have seen enough of American political campaigns to know that candidates sometimes get carried away with the exuberance of their speechwriters. And therefore, I think it will be seen in the correct perspective as the campaign unfolds.
Mr. Secretary,
on your remarks about U.S.-Soviet relations, you said the United States has the military capacity and the political will to resist. Other than rhetoric, how has the United States demonstrated either of those capacities in the past few weeks?
Well, in the past few weeks, there has been no occasion to demonstrate this
military capacity.
I can only speak for the administration. The administration believes that we have the military capacity, and we certainly have the will to resist any expansionist moves or any irresponsible action. We believe also that after an understandable readjustment in the executive congressional balance, that that within the Congress there is a growing realization that in times of crisis, decisive American action may be necessary. What the congressional reaction will be in specific circumstances can, of course, not be determined until the circumstances arise.
One of the charges that's been leveled against the administration is of an unwillingness to use some of the web of relationships that you've built up over the past couple of years with the Soviet Union, to withhold from the Soviets, for example, some of the scientific information or the wheat, as in the grain deal. Can you give one instance where the United States, over the past few months, has implemented any of these tools?
The fact is that as a result of legislative actions, this web of relationships exists more in the imagination of some writers than in reality. There are no technological exchanges of any significance that could have been interrupted. The only item of any significance that was available for interruption was the sale of grain. As you know, the administration is already being accused of having interrupted that for 4 months last year, and it is obvious that that a major trading relationship cannot be interrupted every 3 months and still be available as a part of a fabric of the overall relationship. Except for that, there are no significant exchanges in which the government participates that could have been interrupted. We did interrupt those items that were mostly of a discussion nature that were available to us to indicate our displeasure with the actions that had been taken. But I repeat, the United States will use the tools it has available, and it would have used more tools had they been made available in case they are irresponsible acts.
Are you seeing any reaction whatsoever in any positive form to these warnings that you have been sounding since February? You have said that U.S.-Soviet relations cannot survive another Angola. Are you not having greater difficulty distinguishing between the validity of maintaining these two tracks than you have had before? If the weight that you are putting and you are emphasizing here is so heavy on the danger the Soviet Union is putting on the maintenance of the total relationship.
I'm not absolutely sure that I understand all the ramifications of this question. But as I understand the question, of course, there haven't been any more Angolas since January. I would not consider that conclusive within any 4 months period. And I believe that the Soviet Union is taking stock, just as we are, of the significance of recent events. I can only repeat that the basic validity of our two-track approach remains in effect. Of course, in specific periods, it may be that one has to put more emphasis on one side rather than the other. At this point, we have to warn against the dangers of irresponsible actions, because there is a danger of irresponsible action. But we would also emphasize that we are prepared to work for a better relationship, and the choice is essentially up to the Soviet Union.
Terry, if I can get back to an earlier question.
Your answer about the commitment, American commitment to black majority rule in Africa. The administration is on record as opposing the Byrd Amendment, but doesn't really do anything to get it repealed. You made strong statements reaffirming the commitment to black majority rule only after the Soviet Union and Cuba intervened in Angola. And the earlier question was, how are you going to make credible now, in view of this past history, this commitment and this desire for change in southern Africa?
Well, that will be one of the problems on the on my African trip. And I think that the decision that will have to be made by African countries, as by us, as to what extent they want to continue discussions about the past, or to what extent they're willing to turn to the future. There have been periods, for example, in our Middle East policy, when it would have been equally correct to say that the United States did not pursue an extremely active Middle East policy. When we decided that the time was right to move, for whatever reason, we became more active. The same is true in Africa. I'm going to Africa with an open mind and with the intention of working together with African nations to achieve those objectives which we share. It's now up in part to the African nations to see with what attitude they will respond. We will certainly go with an attitude of goodwill and with an open mind and with some concrete ideas which we are prepared to modify of how these objectives, both in the political field and in the economic field, can be realized.
President Kaunda and President Nyerere have both advocated that war is probably the only solution for the racial problems. And the leaders of the black African movement in Rhodesia have described your visit as an attempt to set up a puppet regime of Africans. Do you think you might be missing the boat on this one? Are you going in a little bit too late?
Well, that remains to be seen. We certainly do not go to set up a puppet regime. It's beyond our capabilities. It's beyond our intentions. The only successful African policy is one in which African nations can achieve African objectives without outside intervention. Whether war is the only means available depends in part on the progress of negotiations between especially the Rhodesian regime and the black liberation movements in that area. We have strongly supported the urgent resumption of negotiations. We have also supported the proposals put forward by the then British Foreign Secretary Callaghan. So I believe that it may be possible to achieve these objectives by peaceful means, and that is certainly our preference. Bernie?
May I ask three related Middle East questions? First of all, has any compromise been reached on the transition fund for Israel?
To the best of my knowledge, no.
Secondly, has there been any change in the U.S. position regarding whether Israel should negotiate with the PLO?
No.
And third, what's your current assessment of the situation in Lebanon and the number of Syrian troops now in Lebanon?
The situation in Lebanon remains precarious. You have many factions with partially incompatible objectives. You have the total absence at this moment of a central authority which, with its own means of enforcing its directives. You have a precarious ceasefire. You have an attempt to work out a constitutional solution. And over all of this hangs the thread of various kinds of outside intervention, some by countries in the area, some by countries outside of the area. We are attempting to assist the parties in walking through this minefield, in avoiding outside intervention, in achieving a political solution that preserves a degree of autonomy for both of the communities and that preserves the integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon. There has been some Syrian military intervention in the border areas. There has not been a massive military intervention in the key areas. We are opposed to the military intervention of outside countries, and we have repeatedly pointed out the factual situation that there is a flashpoint at which events could become irreversible. Up to now, we think that the general evolution in Lebanon has moved in the direction of a constitutional solution which preserves a position for both of the communities. And we believe also that the best way to prevent outside intervention is to bring about this constitutional solution within Lebanon as rapidly as possible. I think we have announced that Ambassador Brown, who has done an outstanding job, is returning for consultations. I'm meeting with him in London tomorrow night, and then he's coming back to the United States. His assignment was always to be a temporary assignment. He will return briefly to Lebanon, and then he will be replaced by Ambassador Malloy in the first part of May.
Mr. Secretary,
if you could take us into your confidence and share some of your private thoughts with us. And it's essentially the question that Barry put you before. What are you not doing in order to accommodate to the political requirements of President Ford under attack by Senator Jackson and Governor Reagan? What areas of American foreign policy are now languishing, loitering, so to speak, because you find yourself hamstrung by political requirements?
Well, it would be very difficult to answer this in absolute terms. There are no occasions when the president and I meet where he would say we cannot do this for political reasons. On the other hand, it is clear that when there are so many candidates in the field and when there's a possibility of being accused of political motivations and making a dramatic move, that there is a temptation or a tendency to defer dramatic moves that could be seen as being politically motivated until that particular element of discord is removed. And that is not so much because of any immediate controversy, but because of the necessity that our foreign policy be seen as the foreign policy of a unified country and not as being inspired by partisan maneuvers. So on the whole, I think it is true that as foreign countries look at the United States every 4 years, there is a certain slowdown in new initiatives that can be carried out. This is part of the price we pay for our free political process. It seems to happen every 4 years, and it is unavoidable to some extent. Though compressing the political campaign would not hurt our foreign policy.
Just a second ago, when you said that there was a threat of some outside intervention in Lebanon from countries outside of the area, not only from countries, were you referring to the Soviet Union?
I don't believe that there is any immediate threat of Soviet intervention in the area. There's the general danger that if there, in case of a Middle East war, that outside powers might be drawn in, at least in the form of confrontation, as has happened in every other Middle East confrontation. Jerry?
Forthcoming trip to Africa and your statements in favor of majority rule, why hasn't the administration made a concerted effort to repeal the Byrd Amendment? There was an attempt by some congressmen to do that in the last 2 weeks, but they said they couldn't do it unless there was administration support.
In the last few weeks, there was an attempt to hang a repeal of the Byrd Amendment to another piece of legislation. I would expect that after my return from Africa, we will take another look at the Byrd Amendment and we will make our position clear to the Congress, insofar as it isn't clear today.
Follow up that, is the U.S. ready to do anything to limit our economic relations with South Africa? And are we ready to give any kind of support, economic or otherwise, to any of the liberation groups, particularly Rhodesian groups?
Well, the United States has already restricted its economic contact, its governmental economic contact with South Africa. But we will announce an integrated policy after my trip to Africa, after I've had an opportunity to meet with key leaders, and after I've had an opportunity to report to the president for any decisions that he may want to make.
Will it be a specific objective, Mr. Secretary, of yours on this trip to try to get negotiations between the Smith regime and the black nationalist government?
Well, I would not say this is a specific objective by which you can measure the trip. We strongly favor the resumption of negotiations on Rhodesia at the earliest possible occasion. The primary objective of the trip is to establish with African leaders a community of concerns with respect to the problem of the political evolution of Southern Africa and with respect to the problem of development, which affects Africa more than any other region of the world, since all of its countries are really developing countries. It's for this reason that I'm returning from Dakar clear across the continent to head our delegation at the UNCTAD conference in Nairobi to put forward what I hope will be considered constructive American proposals to the general problem of development.
What country will you meet with the black leaders of Rhodesia?
Probably in Zambia. Well, we'll see as the trip develops. Certainly, Mr. Nkomo.
A year since the fall of Saigon, you've had an exchange of messages with the leaders in Hanoi. What is your evaluation of the prospects of toward normalization?
Well, the leaders in Hanoi developed certain patterns of dealing with us during the Vietnamese War, which are not always conducive to improving relations between the United States and Hanoi. They have a tendency to proceed by the formulation of ultimatums and to suffer from the misapprehension that we need an improved relationship with Hanoi in order to affect the outcome of our elections. I've read this in various newspapers. In newspaper accounts in Hanoi. As far as the United States is concerned, our principal interest is to get an accounting for the missing in action. And there's no possibility of improving our relationship without an accounting for the missing in action. If Hanoi believes that we are doing this in order to affect the outcome of the election, we are perfectly prepared to wait with discussions until after the election and thereby remove this particular issue. We have stated publicly that we are in principle prepared to have talks with Hanoi in which each side will be free to raise any issue that it wishes, and that then the outcome of these talks can determine whether there's a sufficient basis for normalizing relations. As far as we are concerned, the absolute precondition is a complete accounting for the missing in action.
Secretary,
there seems to have been something of a disparity between your statements on relations with Cuba and the president. The president said that it was all over in attempts to achieve some kind of normalization. You said it was interrupted. The president said Castro was an international outlaw.
You did.
I ask now, in light of this current disparity, what has to be done to get some kind of attempt at normalization with Cuba going again, and how do you implement the hijacking agreement with a man who has been termed an international outlaw?
Well, the president has a more plastic way of expressing himself than I do, or I may have a more complicated way of expressing myself. We, of course, are prepared to implement the hijacking agreement, and we do not approve of any activities that may be mounted from American territory against Cuban shipping. There is no possibility of continuing any discussions with Cuba about normalization of relations as long as Cuban military forces are stationed in Africa, and as long as Cuba continues the attacks on America, on American policy in Puerto Rico and elsewhere. So unless there is a substantial change in Cuban attitudes, the process of improving relations can be considered suspended.
Mr. Secretary, can we ask you about the status of the Hawk missile deal with Jordan? Has it fallen through? Is it true that it's out of question?
The Hawk missile deal with Jordan, which was originally computed primarily on the basis of hardware, when the additional collateral costs became evident, went beyond what Saudi Arabia had originally promised to Jordan. There are now discussions going on between Jordan and Saudi Arabia and between the United States and Saudi Arabia to see whether Saudi Arabia would be prepared to support the additional costs that would be involved in the Hawk deal. These discussions are still going on, and until we have a conclusive answer, we cannot tell whether the Hawk deal can be implemented.
What did you mean when you said the president has a plastic way of expressing himself?
You are absolutely determined that I ruin myself before I get off to Africa.
I don't understand the term.
I'm not aware that plastic melts in heat. I think that the president's use of adjectives is more graphic than mine, because being from the Teutonic tradition, you cannot tell what a sentence of mine means until I place the verb at the end of it.
Of your response to Bernie Kalb's question, that there will be no new initiatives in dealings with the Soviet Union, what, until the Republican convention or until the election?
No, this is not...
Reagan is out of the way? What are you saying exactly?
Wait a minute. Do you want to answer the question? As I understood Bernie Kalb's question, it was in the great philosophical tradition of these press conferences.
Yes.
And he asked me to give a brief political science lecture on the impact of political campaigns on the conduct of foreign policy. And I stated as a general proposition that those new initiatives that might be considered by the public as being motivated by partisan considerations would tend to be deferred until it is clearer that they are not motivated by partisan considerations, if they can be deferred. On the other hand, there are many well-established policies, including SALT, which the president reaffirmed again yesterday, basic relationships with Western Europe, basic relationships with Japan and other areas, as well as new African policy that will, of course, be pursued with energy and conviction during the campaign. I simply responded in a philosophical way to a philosophical question, and you should not draw to.
Can I strip my question of philosophy now and take you to the specific? And can you itemize, for example, what initiatives might in fact be deferred because they might be perceived, as you suggest, as deriving from partisan considerations? You feel is being in fact put off until the election?
No, first of all, I didn't say that matters would be put off until the election. I stated the fact that as far as foreign governments are concerned, the perception of the United States in an election year, with all the controversy that is going on about our basic policies and our basic intentions, tends to be that in an election year there is a slowdown on great new initiatives. There is no specific initiative, as I specifically pointed out, in which has been deferred as a result of the electoral campaign. But it is obvious that the attention of key personnel is focused not exclusively on foreign policy. But at least that's my impression.
To get less philosophical, isn't that the...
continuing violations of human rights in that country, and particularly harassment of Chileans who had met with U.S. congressmen in Chile recently. This would seem to indicate administration displeasure with the military regime's policies, but at the same time it has been announced that you plan to attend the OAS meeting in Santiago in June, and that possibility has been criticized by some as one that would legitimize that dictatorship's policies. Do you plan to attend the meeting, and could you please respond to the criticism?
The meeting in Santiago is a meeting of all the foreign ministers of the Western Hemisphere. There is a meeting of the OAS in Santiago. All other foreign ministers, with one possible exception, are planning to attend. The purpose of my visit to this meeting would be to continue discussions about our Western Hemisphere policy with my Latin American colleagues. And when I go, or if I go, which is highly probable, I would plan to visit the remaining, those countries in Latin America, or most of those countries in Latin America, that I did not have an opportunity to visit on my first trip.
Latin American policy, Secretary, isn't the negotiations on the Panama Canal an example of the sort of thing that's being deferred until after the election? And in that connection, doesn't the controversy over the canal in a way help your negotiating position to show how much opposition and how slowly you have to go?
Well, I don't want to encourage any more of the statements from which we have suffered with respect to the Panama Canal. With respect to the Panama Canal, there are a number of key issues that have to be settled before we can be sure that an agreement is possible. We believe that the basic issue is under what conditions the free and open and neutral access through the canal, which is essential for the United States, can best be guaranteed, and under what conditions our relationships with the Western Hemisphere, with other nations of the Western Hemisphere, can best be preserved. It is our judgment that the negotiations that are now going on are the best way of doing this. Their pace is importantly determined by the ability to settle specific issues. And the degree to which the current debate influences the negotiating process can be argued on both sides.
Of course, the State Department not only knew of some overseas payoffs by American corporations regarding arms sales, but also in some cases the department asked officials to assist in those arms sales. Ambassador Akins is supposed to testify on that next month.
I think those statements are absolutely irresponsible. The only case that has come to my attention, which was after it was published in a newspaper, involved a request to us by the Defense Department to clarify some requests that in turn had been made to the Defense Department with respect to some fees, not with respect to some payoffs. We sent a routine cable, which was done at a very low level, on a routine basis, to find out the Saudi perception of their legal obligations. It was quite the opposite of what has been alleged. It was not an attempt to bring about a payment, but to determine what the legal status of this particular incident was. And I welcome Ambassador Akins testifying about this.
Thank you.
perception of those cables than you do?
Because he's retired as ambassador, and he's been going through his cables at a frantic rate.
Some persons profess to see a great inconsistency.
Would you be discussing with the French government on the proposal by a group of French parliamentarians that the French set up some kind of safeguarding peace force in Lebanon once the new government has been formed?
I have no particular agenda to discuss in Paris. Of course, France, with its long tradition of relationships in Africa, will, I would expect its leaders will want to discuss my impressions of the African trip. Also, we are looking forward to the visit of President Giscard to this country, and I expect to discuss with him in general terms a possible agenda of his meetings with President Ford. Finally, with respect to Lebanon, France again has had a historic relationship. There have been French missions to Lebanon. We have exchanged information during this recent crisis. I do not plan to discuss any particular solution or any particular French role in Lebanon in the solution of the Lebanese crisis, but I'll be prepared to discuss it if my French host would care to raise it.
Said, as I understand him, that his purpose in the Panama Canal negotiations is to retain U.S. rights of control, maintenance, and defense through the life of the pending treaty. Is that your perception of negotiations? Is that the perception of the Panamanians as you understand it?
That is substantially my perception of the negotiations. But in any event, the United States, regardless of control and defense arrangements, will insist on the permanent, free, and neutral and open passage of American ships through the canal.
And to share control and maintenance during the life of the treaty?
That is correct.
You're going to see black Rhodesian leaders on this trip. Will you also see white Rhodesian leaders anywhere?
I don't plan to see white Rhodesian leaders on this trip. I don't consider this trip to be the last word in our African policy. I expect it to be the basis from which an integrated African policy will be developed. And therefore, we expect to be in contact with other leaders in both black African countries as well as in white South African countries or with Southern African regimes after I return to the United States.
Thank you.